Longwave and DAB Digital Radio, the daily service is led by the Reverend Dr. Kirsty Thorpe. Here on Radio 4 FM, it's our Book of the Week. The MP for Hull West, the Right Honourable Alan Johnson, has written a second volume of memoirs, Please Mr. Postman, chronicling the career that took him to high office as a senior government minister. In the late 1970s, he starts to climb the ladder of opportunity by becoming a union representative.
Although trade union elections were held every year, there was little prospect of me being challenged, let alone defeated, as branch chairman. I was attentive to the needs of my members. They could be exasperating, troublesome, apathetic, and sometimes hostile, but I considered myself to be the guardian of their rights under the union's rules, and I think they realised I was doing my best for them, even if they never said as much. The role of a local union representative is a thankless one. Berated by the members for the employer's actions and by the employer for the actions of the members, the most he or she can hope for from either side is a rarely expressed respect. I'd carry a little notebook in the inside pocket of my postman's uniform jacket, into which would go every request, complaint, comment, criticism or observation made to me by the many members who approached me during the course of my working day. I made a point of getting back to every person with some kind of response, although sometimes, by the time I did, whatever the problem was had blown over, or they'd forgotten they'd even raised it with me in the first place. Saturdays were still spent at Queen's Park Rangers matches. The good thing about going to football with Fred Oakham, a scene shifter at the BBC, was that after the match, we could walk across to Television Centre and have a drink while we waited for the crowds to clear before heading home. The BBC Social Club was an egalitarian place where electricians mixed with newscasters, scene shifters with Shakespearean actors, knights of the realm with lads from Shepherd's Bush. You'd travel up in the lift with Tim Brooke Taylor and come down with Dusty Springfield. Among Fred's gang from the props department was a quiet but very funny guy called John Sullivan. It must have been around this time that he capitalised on his proximity to this mix of artists and artisans to hand a script for a comedy programme to a television producer from Light Entertainment. The script was for Citizen Smith, whose main character, Wolfie Smith, was a would-be Marxist urban guerrilla living in a bedsit in Tooting. Within months, John had stopped shifting scenery and was on his way to becoming one of the most successful comedy scriptwriters in the country. Only Fools and Horses will secure his place in British cultural history, but had it not been for his determination and a good pinch of luck, he could so easily have been another of Thomas Gray's flowers, wasting its sweetness on the desert air. My postal round at this time was Littleworth Common, which included Dorney Wood, the stately home built in the 18th century, which was then the country retreat of the Home Secretary, Merlin Rees. I always knew when he was in residence, thanks to the presence of a sturdy policeman in the little security hut halfway down the drive leading to the house. He never stopped and searched my raw mail van, simply waving me through. The mail might not have been checked going into Dorney Wood, but I knew that some letters and packets had already been intercepted in the sorting office. I never saw anyone handling them, but if I nipped away from my sorting frame to collect registered letters or fetch a cup of tea, I might come back to find that some of the mail I'd just sorted had disappeared. I assumed somebody from the investigation branch, who blended into the sorting office background, had taken them to check and that they would be reintroduced into the system later. It did occur to me how easy it would be for a postman to get past the rather rudimentary security that was supposed to protect the Home Secretary. I wish I could describe the interior of Dorney Wood, its lavish reception rooms and its sweeping staircase, but unfortunately I never set foot inside the main house, not once in my 5 years on that delivery. I had to take the mail to a door at the back that led to the servants' quarters. There I'd exchange a cheery word or two with a member of staff and be in and out virtually within seconds. For me, the main function of Dorney Wood and its environs was as a resting place. Once the delivery was finished, My next task was to collect mail from the postboxes perched on poles around the countryside and the pillar boxes in Burnham. None of these could be opened before the advertised collection times, so if I finished the delivery promptly, I'd have to wait somewhere. My chosen spot was the winding lane opposite the entrance to Dorney Wood, where there was a handy lay-by with a lovely view across the fields, and peace, perfect peace. I passed the time there regularly, but when I think back to those days, one summer afternoon comes to mind. I remember sitting in the van with both front windows wound down to let the breeze blow through, reading Thomas Hardy's Tess of the D'Urbervilles. Time seemed to be suspended on the thick, balmy air. I'd just begun to contemplate standing for the Executive Council of the Union and was glimpsing a life beyond the sorting office. But exciting as this potential expansion of my horizons was, the realisation that if I took this route, I might never again enjoy the serenity of Dorney Wood Road on a quiet summer's afternoon gave me a pang of regret. It was one of those idyllic moments which you feel you are already experiencing as a memory, even as it occurs. So I continued my double life as rural postman and secretly ambitious union rep. It was being at the centre of things that interested me, the sense of theatre at conference. I wanted to hold and sway an audience. I was very critical of the Callaghan government. While never a Bennite, I was an opinionated fellow traveller, having decided that the Labour Party was the appropriate vehicle for the transformation of society I wanted to see. I would often pontificate about the final scene in Orwell's Animal Farm, where the pigs, standing on their hind legs and wearing clothes, are no longer distinguishable to the other animals from the humans against whom they'd revolted. This, I'd pronounced to whoever I was talking at, was exactly how I felt when I looked at Labour and Conservative MPs. In the British Legion, on a Sunday lunchtime, I'd drone on about my people, and declare that I wished to put whatever talents I possessed at the service of the working class. I blush now at this patronising nonsense, but I can't deny that the idealistic little twerp in the tank top and flares was me. Leaving aside the self-centred romanticism, I was and remain devoted to two causes, the eradication of poverty and greater equality. All else was a means to those ends. This put me more in tune with Tony Crossland than with Tony Benn, but the late 1970s were a tumultuous time, and the dividing line between democratic socialism and dictatorship of the proletariat was sometimes difficult to discern in the battle for hearts and minds within the labour movement. I became more conscious of my alcohol intake after the suicide of my brother-in-law, Mike. I didn't take a vow of abstinence or join a temperance society, but I was anxious to understand at what stage enjoying a pint became having a drink problem. I'd wince whenever I heard the term alcoholic used in a pejorative or light-hearted way. I now knew what a dreadful illness alcoholism was, and I missed Mike and his gentle ways more than I could tell anybody. Nobody drank at home in those days, except at Christmas or at parties and on other special occasions. Alcohol was consumed on licensed premises. You had tea or coffee indoors. Wine with meals at home was a rarity. By the late 70s, my wife Judy, who could turn her hand to anything, had begun distilling homemade wine as a hobby. Buckets of dandelion and burdock or turnip wine would gurgle away in plastic buckets in the cupboard under the stairs. We'd crack open a bottle of Black Tower or some other German sugar water to accompany Christmas dinner. If we ventured out for a meal at a steakhouse or a restaurant in Windsor for a special celebration, we'd demonstrate our sophistication by ordering Matthias Rosé and taking the bulbous bottle home to serve as a candle holder. Half-empty bottles of sherry or Advocaat could be found at the back of most working-class sideboards, along with the odd small bottle of Babysham or Cherry B, waiting like the Christmas decorations to make an annual appearance. Almost everyone smoked. I always found the generosity of smokers touching. The way that cigarettes were offered round turned them into a small gift presented in a spirit of friendship. Although I'd been puffing away from the age of 12, I rarely got through more than 10 fags a day, lighting my first around lunchtime. I vowed to myself that I'd break the habit by the age of 30, However, in 1978, 2 years ahead of my self-imposed deadline, I stubbed out a cigarette and suddenly decided on the spot that it would be the last I'd ever smoke. The money I would save was a powerful incentive. I decided I would bolster my willpower by setting aside what I would have spent on cigarettes and rewarding myself with LPs instead. Within a week or so, I was able to buy a special yellow vinyl version of Elton John's Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. It was followed at regular intervals by albums from Elvis Costello, Supertramp, Billy Joel, and Joe Jackson. Those records are still redolent to me of an era that was fast disappearing. The end of that decade was marked by the general election of May 1979, which brought in a Conservative government under Margaret Thatcher, the UK's first and to date only female Prime Minister. Joan Lester, our copper-haired, highly rated Labour MP, survived at Slough in 1979 with a reduced majority, but in the country the new Conservative reign was to last for 18 years. My last ever delivery for the post office was completed on a Saturday morning in May 1981, just before my 31st birthday. That afternoon I left Slough for the annual conference in Brighton, where at my third attempt I was elected to the National Executive Council of the Union. My life would never be the same again. Becoming a member of the Executive Council was a big deal. I'd be a lay member, placed on permanent special leave, but only if I failed to be re-elected would I ever go back to work as a postman. On the evening of my election, I went to hear Tony Benn speak. He'd come to conference, uninvited by the executive, to attend a fringe meeting as part of his campaign to be elected deputy leader of the Labour Party. Militant, a group built around the Militant newspaper and formerly known as the Revolutionary Socialist League, had initiated a serious Trotskyite insurgency, stoking a culture of betrayal against anybody connected with the previous Labour government. Anybody, that is, apart from Tony Benn. Despite having been a cabinet minister and part of that government, he not only joined in the condemnation, but led the charge against the colleagues he had worked beside. Benn's leftward lurch made him the idol of those seeking to turn the Labour Party away from democratic socialism, and this all congealed into a toxic mixture of syndicalism and cynicism. Our union had decided to support Dennis Healey, the shadow Foreign Secretary and former Chancellor of the Exchequer, who was the incumbent deputy leader, against the challenge from Benn, and it upheld that decision the following day. In the meantime, I went to listen to what Benn had to say. It wasn't the first time I'd heard him speak. Once again, he was erudite, fluent and persuasive in his rhetoric, and he should have won me over. And yet there was something jarring about his attempts to claim that he was now hunting with the hounds, having previously run with the hare. I distrusted the cult of personality that was being built around him. And while I admit to being attracted by his arguments for more accountable party structures and a greater role for trade unions, the venom directed by his supporters at figures such as Dennis Healey, Jim Callaghan, Barbara Castle, and all the other so-called traitors sickened me. Benn's refusal to lift a finger against this character assassination seemed to me to be the real betrayal.
Please, Mr. Postman, was written and read by Alan Johnson. It's a heavy entertainment production for BBC Radio 4, and tomorrow there are storm clouds approaching. Back to This Morning, and Woman's Hour is approaching. Among today's questions, can women compete with the old boys' network? Jenny Murray will be here after the news.
One of the judges for the 2014 BBC National Short Story Award, Di Spears.
I think this year, every story, you could argue, has a turning point moment. That sense that you suddenly understand the world at a different level.
Five compelling stories from some of the country's most exciting writers.
Once again, we've managed to attract a great calibre of actor. Kerry Mulligan and Rebecca Hall are both reading, but all the voices will take you somewhere else.
You can hear the shortlisted stories next Monday to Friday at 3:30 on BBC Radio 4.